This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
The night sky for July 2017. Well, at least I suppose the night's getting slightly longer in July. So after dark, if you look fairly high in the northwest, you'll see the Plough, part of the constellation Ursa Major, with its bright stars Merak and Dubhe, the pointers leading you up to Polaris, the pole star, very close to the north celestial pole. If you follow the three stars, the handle of the Plough, down towards the southwest, you'll come to the bright star Arcturus in the constellation of Bootes. Moving slightly over to the east from Bootes, there's a nice little circle of stars called Corona Borealis. In fact, not far from Sagittarius, seen from the southern hemisphere, is the equivalent. That's Corona Australis. There's then a not particularly bright region in the sky which contains the constellation of Hercules, we'll come back to later, and then you come to the bright star Vega in Lyra, one of the three stars that make up the summer triangle. Deneb is higher and over to the east, and below them is Altair in Aquila the Eagle, making up, as I said, the summer triangle. Down to the left of that triangle is a rather sweet little constellation called Delphinus the Dolphin. If, with binoculars on a dark night with no moon, you move about a third of the way between Altair and Vega, there's a region called the Cygnus Rift in the Milky Way, which runs through this region, which is rather darker than typical. And in there, you should be able to spot what is called Brocky's Cluster, or the coat hanger, looking a little like an upside-down coat hanger. So some quite nice parts of the sky to see, and I do think that region around Cygnus, Lyra and Aquila is one of the most beautiful parts of the northern sky. Rising far over in the east is the constellation of Pegasus, the winged horse, seen upside down from our part of the world. Well, what about the planets? Well, Jupiter we'll start with. It's now 3 months after opposition, but Jupiter still dominates the low southwestern sky after nightfall. It sets about 1 a.m. BST as July begins. As the month progresses, its brightness falls from -2 to -1.9 magnitudes, as the angular size falls a little from 37 to 34 arc seconds. It lies in Virgo, some 10.5 degrees to the west of Spica, and it's now moving eastwards again after its period of retrograde motion. It will actually pass Spica on September the 11th, on its journey towards the lower parts of the ecliptic. So next year, at transit, it will only reach an elevation of some 25 degrees, and in the two following years, just 18 degrees, before it begins to move back towards the more northerly parts of the ecliptic. Even so, with a small telescope and good seeing, one should be able to see the equatorial bands in the atmosphere, sometimes the Great Red Spot, and up to four of the Galilean moons as they weave their way around it. Now, Saturn came into opposition on June the 11th, so will be at its highest elevation due south at around midnight BST, and by about 10 p.m. BST at the end of July, so will be visible throughout most of the short night. It shines initially at magnitude 0.1, falling to plus 0.2 during the month, has an angular size of about 18 arc seconds. With an angle of 26.7 degrees inclination to the line of sight, the rings are virtually as open as they ever can be. It is just sad that Saturn, now lying in the southern part of Ophiuchus between Sagittarius and Scorpius, only reaches an elevation of about 17 degrees above the horizon when due south, so our view of this most beautiful planet is hindered by the atmosphere. If imaging Saturn or Jupiter, Registax 6 has a tool to align the red, green and blue colour images to largely remove the atmospheric dispersion from the image. At somewhat over £100, one can purchase the ZWO Atmospheric Dispersion Corrector, which uses two contra-rotating prisms to carry out an even better correction, and that, of course, can also be used for visual observing. Mercury reaches greatest elongation east, some 27 degrees in angle from the Sun, on July the 30th. It can be seen low in the west-northwest, around 30 minutes after sunset. Binoculars may well be needed, but of course, please do not use them until after the sun has set. It fades slightly during the month from minus 1 to plus 0.4 magnitudes, whilst its angular size increases from 5.3 to 7.8 arc seconds. And no surface details will, of course, be seen. Well, Mars is hidden in the sun's glare all month, so cannot be observed. Finally, Venus. Well, it's visible in the east before dawn this month, rising around 2.5 hours before sunrise, increasing to about 3 hours as the month progresses. Its magnitude dims slightly from minus 4.2 to minus 4 magnitudes, as its angular diameter shrinks from 18.2 to 14.6 arc seconds. However, at the same time, its illuminated phase increases from 63 to 74%, which explains why the magnitude does not drop too much. Even though it'll be moving back towards the sun, as the angle of the ecliptic to the horizon increases at this time of the year, its elevation before sunrise will actually continue to increase until August. Venus passes the Pleiades cluster on the 5th, the Hyades cluster on the 13th, 14th, and ends the month close to M35 in Gemini. Well, finally, what about the highlights? Well, June is perhaps the best month to observe Saturn. It's now due south and highest in the sky in the late evening. It's lying very low in the southern part of Ophiuchus, some 16 degrees up and to the left of the orange star Antares in Scorpius. Held steady, binoculars should enable you to see Saturn's brightest moon, Titan, at magnitude 8.2. A small telescope will show the rings with magnifications of times 25 or more, and one of 6 to 8 inches, with a magnitude of about times 200, coupled, I must say, with a night of good seeing, and that's when the atmosphere is calm, will show Saturn and its beautiful ring system in its full glory. As Saturn rotates quickly, with a day of just 10.5 hours, its equator bulges slightly, so it appears a little squashed. Like Jupiter, it does show belts, but their colours are muted in comparison. The thing that makes Saturn stand out is, of course, its ring system. The two outermost rings, A and B, are separated by a gap called Cassini's division, which should be visible in a telescope of 4 or more inches aperture if the seeing conditions are good, but sadly, as it's so low above the horizon, that may not be possible. Lying within the B ring, but far less bright and difficult to spot, is the C or crape ring. Due to the orientation of Saturn's rotation axis of 27 degrees with respect to the plane of the solar system, the orientation of the rings, as seen by us, changes as it orbits the sun, and twice each orbit they lie edge onto us and so can hardly be seen. This last happened in 2009. As I've said, they are now fully opened out, currently at about 26.5 degrees to the line of sight. And from this month on, the ring's orientation will begin to narrow until March 2025, when they will appear edge-on again. July is a good month to find the globular cluster M13 in Hercules and spot the double-double in Lyra. They're two very nice objects to spot with binoculars in the eastern sky well after dark this month. Two-thirds of the way up the right-hand side of the four stars that make up the keystone in the constellation of Hercules is M13, the best globular cluster visible in the northern sky. Just to the left of the bright star Vega in Lyra is the multiple star system Epsilon Lyrae, often called the double-double. With binoculars, a binary star is seen, but when observed with a telescope on the night of good seeing, each of these stars is revealed to be a double star. Hence the name. Well, around the summer solstice, so in early July, is a good time to spot noctilucent clouds. They're most commonly seen in the deep twilight towards the north from our latitude. They are the highest clouds in the atmosphere at heights of around 80 kilometres or 50 miles, normally too faint to be seen. They are visible when illuminated by sunlight from below the northern horizon, whilst the lower parts of the atmosphere are in shadow. So on a clear, dark night, as light is draining from the northwestern sky long after sunset, look towards the north, and you might just spot them. Well, around midnight on July the 7th and 8th, you can see the waxing moon to the upper right of Saturn. On the 20th July, if it's clear before dawn, there's a nice grouping of Venus, the star Aldebaran, and the bright, thin crescent moon. After sunset on the 25th of July, Given a low western horizon and clear skies, there's a chance of spotting Mercury down to the lower right of a very thin crescent moon. Binoculars may well be needed, but please do not use them until after the sun has set. Finally, on July the 1st and the 15th, there are two good nights, if it's clear, to observe the Alpine Valley on the moon. Close to the terminator on those nights is the Apennine mountain chain that marks the edge of Mare Imbrium. Towards the upper end, you should see a cleft across them called the Alpine Valley. It is about 7 miles wide and 79 miles long. As shown in the image I have on the night sky page, a thin rill runs along its length, which is quite a challenge to observe. If the moon is waxing, then over the next two nights, the dark crater Plato and the young crater Copernicus will come into view. This is a very interesting region of the moon. Well, I do hope you get some clear nights in July and I have a chance to look at our wonderful skies. Good hunting.
Thanks for that, Ian. And for our Antipodean listeners, here's Claire Bretherton with the night sky where you are.
Kia ora, and welcome to the July Jodcast from Space Place at Carter Observatory in Wellington, New Zealand. Jupiter is still high in our evening skies this month, midway up the northwestern sky after sunset. Shining at magnitude minus 2.1 with its bright golden glow, Jupiter will be the first star-like object you'll see as the sky begins to darken. Just above is bluish Spica, representing the ear of wheat held by Virgo. The waxing crescent moon will pass close to Jupiter on both the 1st and 29th of the month. Lower in the west, Mercury is making an appearance in the evening sky. At the start of the month, it sets just an hour after the sun, but by the end of July, when it reaches its greatest elongation from the sun, it will remain in our skies until 8 p.m. On the 25th, Mercury will form a close group with Regulus in Leo and a thin crescent moon. Saturn is high in the northeast and is a great target for a telescope of any size, with its rings still at almost maximum tilt. Look out for Saturn's largest moon, Titan, looking like a star at around 4 times the ring diameter from the planet. Saturn continues to sit just below Antares in Scorpius, with the claws of the scorpion to the left and his tail curving around to the right. In New Zealand, we see this as the Fishhook of Maui, Te Matua Maui. Below Scorpius is an upside-down teapot formed from the brightest stars in the constellation of Sagittarius. The bright center of the Milky Way runs through Scorpius and Sagittarius, so there are many stunning objects to explore in this part of the sky. Lying along the tail of the scorpion, close to the orange third-magnitude star Zeta Scorpii, is NGC 6231, a bright cluster of stars which looks like a small comet. At magnitude 2.6, this is easily visible to the naked eye. Estimated to be only 3.2 million years old and nearly 6,000 light-years away, NGC 6231 covers an area of the sky similar in size to the Pleiades, but its stars are much more luminous. If the cluster was placed at the same distance as the Pleiades, then some of its stars would be amongst the brightest in the nighttime sky. With a good pair of binoculars from a dark site, NGC 6231 appears in an area of nebulosity and intermingled with open clusters Trompler 24 and Colander 316 to form a lovely complex sometimes known as the Scorpius Lizard. Also nearby is NGC 2642. With binoculars, its three brightest stars stand out from a faint background glow. A little above, NGC 6193 is also visible to the naked eye at magnitude 5.2, and nearby NGC 6167 is worth a look in binoculars or a small telescope. Below, about halfway between the scorpion's sting and the spout of the teapot, is M7. This is another open cluster of stars easily visible to the naked eye at magnitude 3.3, and a lovely sight through a good pair of binoculars. It contains about 80 stars brighter than 10th magnitude and covers an area of 1.3 degrees diameter. Current estimates suggest a distance of 980 light-years and an age of 220 million years old, still pretty young in astronomical terms. M7 has been known since ancient times and was first recorded by Ptolemy in 130 AD, who described it as a nebula following the sting of Scorpius. Because of this, it is also sometimes referred to as a Ptolemy cluster. Nearby and somewhat fainter, the Butterfly Cluster, or M6, is also a nice sight in binoculars. The stars will all appear to be around the same brightness, and the open-winged shape that gives the cluster its name should be easy to pick out. To the left of the teapot spout, and just about visible to the naked eye, is another lovely Messier object, the Lagoon Nebula, or M8. This is a huge cloud of interstellar gas and dust, where new stars are being formed. M8 is a great example of an H2 region, where UV radiation from hot young stars is ionizing the leftover hydrogen gas and causing it to glow. These emission nebulae often appear pink in color photographs, and the Lagoon Nebula is a good target for binoculars or a small telescope. Another good target is the Trifid Nebula, discovered by Charles Messier in 1764, and famed for the three-lobed appearance which earned it its name. It is an interesting object to observe, as it combines both an emission and reflection nebula, along with an open cluster of stars. There are also a number of globular clusters in this part of the sky. The brightest is M4, and this is also one of the easiest to find, lying just 1.3 degrees west of Antares. Appearing as a small fuzzy ball in binoculars or small telescopes, a slightly larger telescope will begin to pick out individual stars. Also in this region, near the top of the teapot, is M22, one of the first globular clusters ever discovered in 1665, and one of the closest at just 10,600 light-years. From its bright centre, the Milky Way stretches overhead through Crux, the Southern Cross, and onto Carina, Vela, and Puppis above the southwestern horizon. Together, these three constellations make up the great ship Argo Navis, famous in Greek mythology as that used by Jason and the Argonauts in their quest for the Golden Fleece. Just to the left of the Milky Way is Carina's brightest star Canopus, or Alpha Carinae, the second brightest in the nighttime sky. Its Maori name is Atutahi or Autahi, which means to stand alone, because of its position just outside the band of our galaxy. In the other direction, the Milky Way drops down to the eastern horizon and the bright star Altair in the constellation of Aquila, the Eagle, which rises around 9 p.m. at the start of the month. In the morning skies, our last visible planet, brilliant Venus, rises after 4 a.m. Venus is so bright that you can really only mistake it with the headlights of an aeroplane, and it provides a useful pointer to help find Matariki or the Pleiades as the cluster rises before dawn. Venus sits just above Matariki at the beginning of the month, but slowly moves down between Matariki and Taurus's brightest star Aldebaran as the month progresses, sitting just below Aldebaran on the morning of the 18th. Wishing you clear skies from the team here at...